from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, small businesses and Silicon Valley innovation are the keys to reinvigorating U.S. manufacturing. That's the message of Ro Khanna's new book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. What are his plans for reviving the economy? The former Deputy Secretary of Commerce joins us to discuss his job creation ideas and more after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Bay Area-based technology attorney and former Deputy Secretary of Commerce under President Obama, Ro Khanna, joins us in studio for this morning's opening Forum Hour. A former member of the White House Business Council, he's now a visiting lecturer at Stanford and author of a recently published book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. And he joins us for this Forum Hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess the place to begin is you are very bullish on manufacturing and feel that it's still the key to America's future. Last jobs report fell 15,000 in August, largest monthly drops in 2 years. So some would say it's really in decline.
Well, I think we have to look at the broader trend, not just the last month's number. And if you look at the last 2 to 3 years, there have been almost 400,000 manufacturing jobs created. And as I make the argument in the book, we still are a manufacturing leader. We produce about 20% of the world's products. China does about 20%, and we do it with one-tenth of the economy. China does it with four-tenths of the economy. So we have this incredible productivity advantage that still makes us competitive in manufacturing.
And yet China is getting ahead of us in so many areas, or so it would seem. Not only China, but one could argue that Brazil, Korea, they're all very hungry and maybe have more innovation going on, or to some extent they're eclipsing America in many manufacturing areas.
Well, there's no doubt that there are certain areas that we have lost offshore. But if you look at our worker productivity, we're still the world leader. We have 6 times the productivity of China, almost 1.5 times the productivity of Japan and Germany, and certainly much higher than Brazil or India. So the argument is that not all manufacturing is going to stay in the United States, but advanced manufacturing, manufacturing that requires innovation, specialized skills, customization, that is something we can retain. And if we look at the aerospace industry, we're still a leader in making planes. We still make 80% of steel for the domestic market in the United States. And we are do extraordinary in medical equipment, in chemical products. So we have a lead in quite a number of sectors still in manufacturing.
Speaking of steel, you use a number of examples, and I want to get to Steel Dynamics CEO, one of your examples, among other examples, a guy making rails. Who would have thought rails would be doing as well or as prosperous? But your model, to some extent, is a Silicon Valley model. That's where your bailiwick is. And there's some who are really skeptical. Is this real blue-collar manufacturing? Is this going to really provide the kind of jobs that are traditionally American jobs that are associated with blue-collar? I mean, I think it was Robert Reich who you quoted as saying, well, I might as well accept it. We're a service economy now.
Well, I have a lot of respect for Reich, but I think Reich is wrong. We still have about 12 million folks in American manufacturing, and that's a sizable middle class sector, workforce that's in manufacturing. And many of these people are doing jobs that pay about 20% more than services. And it's still if you go around the country, we have people making blenders or making fire suits or making textiles, we're making steel. So I don't think it's just a Silicon Valley model. Now, the argument I make is that the manufacturers that are doing well value the creativity of their employees, encourage innovation. But that's not just innovation in high technology. It's innovation in almost any product.
Let's talk, though, for a moment about Solyndra, because you do write about it in your book, and there are many who see this as a failure of the whole green technology advancement for the United States. You go into detail about how the DOE may have gone awry here in some respects, but also you talk about the reasons for the failure. And in fact, I'm just going to really actually go to your book. You talk about the burn rate and Chinese dumping and bad luck. I mean, it's essentially the three things as you see it.
Yes.
So, but China beat us there too, didn't they?
Well, China has the silicon crystalline technology, which is the older technology. And the advance in solar was the SIGS technology, which Solyndra and others used. And the hope was that that would give American manufacturing an advantage. Now, what happened is the price of the Chinese silicon crystal fell, and they ended up dumping a lot of that into the United States against what would be fair trade practices. And that put a lot of competitive pressures on American solar companies. Now, that's not the only reason Solyndra failed, but it's an untold story, which is the Chinese dumping of cheap solar panels. So I don't think they beat us in the sense that their technology is still older and there is a new technology in the United States that should be developed, but they are competitive on this older technology.
Yeah, you also write about Chinese currency manipulation. What would you do about that, or what would you have the government do about that?
Well, I think my view is Paul Krugman's view, that we ought to make a demand. We ought to say, first of all, that they are manipulating their currency, label them a currency manipulator, and ask them and demand in our bilateral negotiation that they have a free-floating currency. And the reason is not just because it's going to help American workers, but also it's going to, in my judgment, be good for the Chinese people. I mean, right now you have a communist government that's favoring elite exporters at the expense of their own consumer welfare and consumer access to products and the consumer purchasing power. And so I think a fair trading regime would not only benefit American workers, but allow Chinese consumers to buy products that they need.
We're talking with Ro Khanna, and his new book is Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. It makes the argument that national security and world power remain here in the United States and remain a necessity and are best kept here in the United States. And we do that how?
We do that, one, by having an educated workforce with the right skills in manufacturing. We have had cuts in vocational education, cuts in community colleges, and don't have the right workforce. We do that by respecting manufacturing and the trades, the labor unions that are still producing skilled workers, and saying that these folks have a important role in our society. People say, well, manufacturing is repetitive work. I often say, well, legal work is repetitive work. You cut and paste documents and then submit briefs. I mean, there's some creativity to it, but a lot of it's repetitive. Same thing goes with manufacturing. Is some of the work repetitive? Absolutely. But in modern manufacturing, to operate CNC machines, to be innovating with lean manufacturing techniques on an assembly floor requires creativity. So one is just respecting our manufacturers. And finally, I think having the right tax and immigration and regulatory policy to attract manufacturers back to the United States.
Small Business Jobs Act that provides loans, that sort of thing that Jackie Speier, Congresswoman Jackie Speier, is pushing?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what the administration has done, and I know Jackie Speier has been a champion in increasing the amount of loans that SBA provides, in increasing the cap from $2 million to $5 million, that is extraordinarily important in helping small and medium-sized manufacturers and in helping startups, which often face the valley of death because of a lack of financing. So the access to capital is essential. And you look at Apple, FedEx, Staples. These are all companies that benefited from SBA loans. I think continuing that is essential.
Well, in fact, you argue about tax credits or five-year tax holidays for manufacturers, which presumably would expand or set up factories in the United States to a greater degree.
Yes. And the great debate about taxes, not to be partisan about it, just to talk about the economics, is do you cut taxes on the wealthy or on people's income, or do you cut taxes on activities that are going to create jobs? And the argument I make in this book is if we're going to cut taxes, let's cut taxes on initiatives where people are investing in equipment, or if they're building factories, or if they are hiring new individuals. And those are the type of tax incentives that will create jobs, manufacturing jobs, and other jobs in the economy.
Ro Khanna here with us in studio again. His new book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. He was Deputy Secretary of Commerce under President Barack Obama. You had political aspirations. You raised a good deal of money thinking maybe that you would go after the congressional district that now Pete Stark is incumbent in, that Eric Swalwell, former Dublin councilman and Alameda prosecutor, is facing off against Stark. And why did you decide to pull your hat out?
Well, I have public service aspirations. I am passionate about public service. I'm passionate about a career in public service. And I believe in this country we need to restore a belief that that politics and a political career is a noble profession. And so I make no apologies for having a public service ambition. And I think my work in the administration at a national level gives me an insight about what America needs to do to be economically competitive and what policies we should have to create jobs.
And there were many who were saying, run, Ro, run, really, weren't they? I mean, you got a lot of money behind you. You had a lot of money behind you.
And at the right time, I will run for office. That said, I have great respect for Congressman Stark. I actually worked with him on an issue dealing with NUMMI and bringing funds back once the NUMMI plant closed. And I think he's had a 40-year public service career standing up for a lot of progressive issues. And frankly, my focus and our focus as a Democratic Party should be, how do we reelect this president? How do we help Speaker Pelosi become Speaker of the House? And at this point, I thought those were more important priorities than taking on someone who I respected.
There are those who say Congressman Stark has been most intemperate. It's time for him to step down, or time maybe to somebody to take the position away from him. You don't share that point of view, right?
My view is I can only speak to my personal interactions with Congressman Stark, in which point he has been exceedingly gracious and thoughtful. And on issues of manufacturing where we've worked together, I've had a very good relationship. But it's a democracy, and you know, it's great for people to run. And at the right time for me, I will run. And I welcome people into the political system, and I think more people should engage in politics and should run for office.
When the NUMMI plant closed in Fremont, you went to work to build a new manufacturing base. Let's talk about what happened as a result of that, kind of putting your shoulder to the wheel, as it were.
Well, my work was at the Commerce Department. We were able to secure a grant to bring back to Fremont, and Fremont used the grant to help figure out how to bring new manufacturing to the area. And there was a big debate in Fremont at the time about whether we should have just residential housing or whether Fremont could become an advanced manufacturing hub. And my view and others in the delegation's view was it really should become an advanced manufacturing hub. And so some of the money that we brought back was used for a planning grant to see what Fremont could do now that NUMMI had closed. Then we also worked in the administration with Ed Montgomery and the local delegation to bring back funds for worker retraining. And there's a worker retraining center there so that some of the folks at NUMMI could be employed in other advanced manufacturing jobs.
I'm going to take this opportunity to invite those of you listening and join us. I said I would hear some examples from Ro Khanna's book of, well, manufacturers whom you may not have heard of or may not know of, but nevertheless who we should bring to your attention. In the meantime, should America put its hopes on manufacturing, or is that horse out of the barn, so to speak? And to what degree do you believe in the ongoing and the ongoing power of manufacturing in the United States and the ongoing potential future tied to manufacturing. I'd like to open the phone lines and invite you to join us on that and hear what you have to say. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now, again, by calling us at 866-733-6786. Welcome your comments or any questions you might have for our guest, Rob Khanna. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post any of your questions or comments on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or communicating with us by going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Let's talk about some of these success stories as you see it. Vitamix, blenders. You mentioned it before. You alluded to it.
Well, I was very surprised to learn that almost any blender that makes your Frappuccinos at Starbucks is made in the United States. It's made by a company called Vitamix in Cleveland, Ohio. And the way that Vitamix is able to make these blenders is they worked with Starbucks to customize the product, so there are no lingering ice chips in your Frappuccino drink, so that these blenders don't make much sound. And a lot of times Starbucks are co-located in Barnes & Nobles, and they want customers to linger, so they want blenders that make make very little sound, and that last a long time. And Vitamix was able to do this and win the business. And, you know, it's one of the stories. I've had so many people come up to me, say they've read the book and they've gone and bought a Vitamix blender. So
Did good for them.
I have.
I don't know what you did for electric cars, but we'll go back to Fremont. You've got Tesla in there in the book.
Yep. Yeah. Well, Tesla is I think, promising example of a new manufacturing. I mean, looking at manufacturing for the next generation of automobiles that are going to be energy efficient, that are extraordinary amount of technology. And, of course, the challenge for them is how to build these cars at a price range for the middle class. And I think and we're all hoping that they succeed, and it can be a boon for the region in Fremont and the East Bay if they do.
And you also, we alluded to before, mentioned steel and rails. This is Steel Dynamics. You talked to the CEO, and you really got a picture there that's quite brightening for manufacturing.
It is. If you look at Steel Dynamics, first of all, they pay their employees about $30 an hour, non-unionized, unfortunately, but they do still pay and treat their workers very, very well. So it's this myth that you can't pay workers well and still be competitive. So how do they do it? Well, for 1 ton of steel, it takes them 0.25 labor hours to produce that ton of steel. Comparatively, it takes someone in China almost 8 hours to produce a ton of steel. So they have introduced processes that are allowing them to be extraordinarily efficient in production, and this is enabling them to be one of the most competitive steel manufacturers in the world.
You also mentioned firefighting suits. This is Globe Manufacturing, which you profile in your book as well.
Absolutely. Globe was founded in 1887. It's a fourth-generation company. It's one of the things that that struck me about manufacturers in general. Many are family-owned businesses going back generations. And Globe makes extraordinary fire suits that have sensors that are able to fight off pathogens. And I tell the story in the book after 9/11, when the Pentagon was burning, firefighters who were using the Globe fire suits were able to work through the night, and others who weren't using them were not. And the Pentagon actually called Rob Freese at Globe, and Globe was allowed to take a mercy flight 2 days after 9/11 and deliver these fire suits so that the men and women in the company could put out the fire at the Pentagon. It's an inspiring story, and it speaks to the resolve and patriotism of American manufacturers, again, many family-owned.
Well, in fact, the book is kind of brief. I mean, forgive me for using that word in your other hat of being a lawyer, but about the competitiveness and innovation still being alive and enduring in America. And some of these stories, indeed, of entrepreneurial spirit really are inspiring, but there's going to be a lot of work that has to be done to, well, buoy up the manufacturing base in this country. And I mean, vocational training in high schools, for example, this sort of thing really would be, and a lot in secondary education, to particularly inspire the spirit of innovation.
Absolutely. And I talk about one is, again, restoring vocational training in high school. I mean, I tell the story about how there was someone in the White House my age who didn't know what a machinist did. And I think we've lost as a generation an appreciation for hands-on work and the difficulty and skill of that work. And having the type of education that doesn't track students, but gives them the option of pursuing careers in manufacturing and lets them know that these are respected careers is extraordinarily important. And then I think community college, as you pointed out, is important because the jobs on the factory floor today and in manufacturing today require greater facility with math, greater ability to understand programming and machines. And this requires some facility in technology or in science. And we need to prepare our workforce for that and partner with apprentice programs that many skilled trades or unions have and support them in cultivating a skilled workforce.
Not to to get into the territory of partisan politics here, but there is an $8 billion proposal from the Obama administration for community college training programs. And, you know, some would say this is not the way to do it. I mean, to get entrepreneurial spirit and innovation, you've got to have the government, I suppose you could call it a libertarian point of view, government stay out of things, not necessarily provide these kind of programs.
And my question would be to them, where do they find the justification in American history? Because if you go back in American history, all the way back to Alexander Hamilton, who argued that to be a world superpower, we need strong investment from government in infrastructure, in universities. And then Abraham Lincoln with the community college land grants that set up our community colleges, or Herbert Hoover as Secretary of Commerce, who invested in aviation and set up our aviation industry, or even Ronald Reagan, who through Semitech helped support the semiconductor industry. We see that there has been a bipartisan tradition in this country of government collaboration with the private sector to create growth, of a government responsibility in supporting education and infrastructure. And you look at our own state, there was no secret with Pat Brown. Secret was education and infrastructure. This stuff isn't rocket science. And one of my favorite quotes in the book is from Richard McGregor, who says, "The problem and challenge for America is not that it needs to be more like China. The challenge for America is that it needs to be more like America." And I think if we look at American history, we will see that there has always been a role for strategic government investment.
Well, we should mention that President Obama and Vice President Biden and Governor Romney and Congressman Ryan all support retraining for jobless.
They do, in theory. But the question is, what do the budgets reflect? And there's one thing. I mean, who could be against education? Who's going to say we're against retraining? The question is, where are the priorities? What is the budget commitment? And I think the president ought to even do more. I mean, there's $8 billion on community colleges, but there's not sufficient amount of funding on vocational education at the high school level and support for high schools like Austin Polytech that are doing an extraordinary job in preparing students for manufacturing in a predominantly African-American underprivileged area in Chicago. So I would love this to be a bipartisan issue, the retraining of workers, but let's see where the budgets are.
Ro Khanna, our guest in studio, his book Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. Well, what do you think? Is it the key to America's future, and just how much of a key is fitting in the door here in terms of opening up possibilities? And we're kind of taking the pulse of manufacturing, but also looking ahead, obviously, and you may want to weigh in. Again, our email address, forum@kqed.org. You can post any questions or comments or your point of view on Facebook. You can also send us a tweet by going to our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum, or our website, kqed.org/forum, or call us, 866-733-6786. We hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Small businesses and Silicon Valley innovation are the keys to reinvigorating U.S. manufacturing. That's the message of Ro Khanna's new book, Entrepreneurial Nation, subtitled Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. And we're talking about his plans for reviving the economy and, creating more jobs, and also a little bit about his political aspirations, covering a broad swath here as we like to do. And let's hear from you. In fact, let's begin with Catherine, who's joining us from the state capital of Sacramento. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. I have two aspects I want to touch on. One is glad to hear that Mr. Canada is thinking of running for Congress, but what does he think about Pete Stark's proposed bill 3242 to put a tax on carbon? The second aspect I wanted to touch on is, as a shopper and an environmentalist, I would like to buy things made in the United States, made in the USA, such as we had as an anthem in the 30s, but I can't find clothing or shoes or small appliances that are made in the United States. What policy changes must we make to make this happen, or is it just a matter of personal preference?
Well, thank you for the questions. Let me answer the second question first. One of the challenges with American manufacturing is a lot of the consumer goods have gone offshore, and we've retained advanced manufacturing or heavy equipment manufacturing. And so people who go into stores often see that a lot of the things are made in China, and the bigger equipment, steel or airplanes, people don't see that. And so there's this perception that all manufacturing has gone offshore. That said, to encourage the consumer goods to come back, I think we have to help the small and medium-sized manufacturers, companies like Vitamix, which are often supplying to niche markets that are customizing their products, that are innovating in design, because that's the only way they can compete when it comes to consumer goods. And helping them means small business loans to provide capital, the manufacturing extension partnership that works with these companies to be competitive, helping them export through the United States Foreign Commercial Service, and providing the right tax credits. On carbon policy, you know, I do think that is the one of the biggest issues to have the right energy policy, is to have the right price of carbon. My personal view is that the politically most achievable goal is to have the Henry Waxman Markey bill passed, and my hope is that if the president is reelected, that would be a priority in the new administration.
And Catherine, we thank you for your call, and we go right to another caller from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Tim joins us. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Nice to speak to you. I'm a self-employed cabinet maker. My wife's self-employed, so we're both, you know, entrepreneurs, and I share some frustration with government regulation, and I know I am a libertarian, but I consider myself an independent. And the problem is, I could cite a specific example of government regulation. The woman in, I think it was Michigan, who wanted to start her own dreadlock business doing dreadlocks, and they came in and shut her down and said she had to get a cosmetology license and go through all these hoops, and she couldn't afford to do it. But she was trying to run a business and get things going for herself. And I would certainly think for low-income people especially, the less and I understand you need regulations. But, you know, when government gets too involved, and I know you're a lawyer, sir, and most it seems like government is rife with lawyers, it's just frustrating for us when we have to deal with this kind of situation. You know, I'm in remodeling and stuff like that, and some of the regulations are just archaic and ridiculous. And if they made it easier for us, more people could start their businesses.
Well, kind of.
I appreciate the concern, and it's something I heard from small businesses and manufacturers across the country. The complexity of the regulations, the sense that they had to wait years to get the right permitting. And Andy Grove from Intel said, you know, when he would go to Malaysia, he would have to deal with one person who would get all the regulations that he needed to comply with done within a few months. And here it would often take years. So the question is, do we need regulations? Absolutely. But how do we have them streamlined so there is a one-stop shop in being able to get these, comply with these regulations easily? We need that at the federal level. And there's an effort at way called Select America, which is trying to streamline the federal bureaucracy so that manufacturers can go to one place to comply with all these regulations and do it quickly. And we need an effort, in my judgment, in California, collaboration between the state and local government to streamline some of the regulatory burdens and make sure that our manufacturers have an easy way of complying and don't have to go to 20, 30 different agencies.
And we thank Tim for his call. Let me go to a email here from a listener named Jay who writes, I'm listening to your show, and like the PR surrounding the SBA, your guest comments are totally disconnected from the current reality. I am now winding down my startup manufacturing company. We should have been a poster child for the stimulus. We are in the auto industry. We are a manufacturing company. We are onshore. We are in California. We produce a part that is superior to any other at a cost lower than any foreign operation. The market for our parts was and remains strong. I invested over $1 million of my own money to develop the technology, secure shop space, etc. When I needed $300,000 in working capital, I went to the SBA. The SBA will only loan money to a startup if you have real estate as collateral. If I had that, why would I ever go through the pain? The SBA. So I'm shuttering what would have been an amazing operation. We would have employed people in California, where unemployment is through the roof, in different parts of California. Temecula. The best part of my experience is that while I was being turned down, I got to read a story in TechCrunch lauding a new entrepreneur for using his SBA loan to start a company that offshored all of its manufacturing to China. I'm completely disenchanted with both parties.
Well, I look forward to meeting this person and getting more details. I mean, there's no doubt that the SBA has reform that needs to be done. I mean, one of the reforms is if you're a small startup which has venture capital invested, as the laws are currently written, it's very difficult to get SBA funding. I don't know the specifics on the this gentleman's case and what collateral he submitted. I mean, and it's a fine balance because we don't want loans that are not secured. On the other hand, we want to encourage a small business and make it easy for them to give the type of collateral that's necessary to secure these loans. And I'm all for liberalizing the program. Frankly, the criticism, though, is on the side of the right, which says we demand 100% success rate on these loans. I mean, they're criticizing the president's energy program, which has had three failures, many more successes, three failures out of about 40, as saying, well, if one fails, then the program doesn't work. And I'm sure if one company under the SBA loan failed, they would point to that and say, get rid of the SBA. So I'm all for saying, let's have some risk tolerance. Let's provide these loans to qualified small and medium-sized businesses and not make it make them jump through an enormous amount of hoops. And if they have a reasonable collateral and reasonable business plan, I think it's something we ought to be supporting.
What's reasonable collateral?
Well, that depends. I mean, I think that I'd have to look through the regulations and see what this person has. I mean, we want to make sure, one, they need to have a path to profitability. Two, the government needs to be reasonably sure that they're going to get the money back. I mean, we don't want to be – the SBA has an extraordinary record of providing loans where they are getting them repaid. And if we don't want to go the way of some of the banks in Wall Street where they – lent out money and with no sense of whether those loans would be repaid. And so I think we want to retain those standards. But look at how if there are small businesses that aren't being able to meet those needs and have different forms of collateral, we should be open to that.
Here's Enrique who writes, what are the numbers? Is the average factory wage in China a dollar an hour? Why hire Americans? And how does our 30% high school dropout rate affect our competitiveness?
It's a great question. Well, first, labor is often only 10% of a manufacturing product's cost. And there's no doubt that we can't compete on wage. And this is why we're never going to win a race to the bottom. You're not going to – just lowering someone's salary in the United States is not going to allow us to compete with a $1 or $2 wage in China or, if not China, Vietnam or Malaysia. How then do we compete? We compete because we have a productivity advantage. We have a technology advantage. We're often more innovative. And we can compensate for a higher labor cost, which, again, is only about 10% of a product's total cost. And that's how many of our manufacturing are competing with low-wage countries.
Well, on the subject of competition, I want to read another email from Alan, who writes, if much of what technological innovation accomplishes is to increase worker productivity, It takes ever fewer workers necessary to produce what consumers need and want. Don't we have to rethink how we work if we are to avoid chronic high unemployment and its attendant social instability? And how can we expect workers in a democracy with hard-won gains to compete with workers in a dictatorship?
Well, now I know I'm on the forum. That's a thoughtful question. You know, John Maynard Keynes made a similar argument back in the 1930s, where he said, if there is going to be continuous automation and technology, what need is there going to be for workers? And he predicted that in 15 years, which would have been in the 1945 or 1950, we would have a 15-hour work week because technology would render work less necessary. And we'd all enjoy leisure and could all write poetry and read philosophy. The reason that didn't work out is, in my judgment, Keynes didn't account for the insatiable human need for consumption and demand. He never thought that one day we'd need iPhones and we'd need DVRs and we'd be interested in notebooks. And so as productivity increases, so does the basket of goods. And if we increase productivity in making one product but produce many different products and many different goods, that creates the need for a stable workforce because we may need less workers to make one product but need more workers to make many more goods. And Peter Drucker, the famous business guru, has estimated that in an advanced industrial society such as the United States, manufacturing employment can stabilize at about 10% to 12% of the workforce.
John Maynard Keynes and Peter Drucker were both writing before Jeremy Rifkin came along and said the end of work. I mean, he was obviously a bit hyperbolic and way beyond in his estimates what occurred. But the technological revolution has really lost many jobs, many, many jobs.
There's no doubt that automation has lost jobs. I mean, there's no doubt it's lost jobs across—
And traditional manufacturing jobs.
And traditional manufacturing jobs, absolutely. But they have created opportunities for— One, they have lost traditional manufacturing jobs. Two, they've created opportunities, though, for different types of manufacturing jobs. Now you need to know how to operate CNC machines. Now you need to know how to operate the robotics that are in these factories. But there is no doubt that there have hurt manufacturing jobs which don't have higher skill, and there is a greater degree of skill required to do many of these jobs.
More of your calls. Let's go to Mark next. Mark, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I really appreciate the show and the topic. I worked in the solar sector and have for many years and took some of the comments about Solyndra in a slightly different light. I think that the majority of the 100,000 jobs created in the solar sector really are in the downstream, what's called the downstream segment. That's the segment that builds the power plants and maintains them. So I don't disagree that we need a coherent manufacturing policy, but I do think I'll take a well-built, low-priced Chinese module every day, and I'll make a lot more jobs that cannot be exported with building and maintaining these power plants than, you know, low-priced manufacturing jobs, which ultimately are going to be outsourced.
And you say what to that, Rick?
It's a fair point, and it's a debate. There are people who argue that solar panel installation creates jobs, and that is more vital than solar manufacturing. That we ought to emphasize sort of the solar installation and the business around that. And my view of it is, fine, as long as every country is playing by the same rules. That if China were playing fair and had developed advanced manufacturing technology for solar panels or technology that was more adept to winning in the market, I would say fine, let the chips fall where they may. What is unacceptable is any country cheating or skirting the rules. And so for China to dump any product, whether it's solar panels or whether it's blenders or whether it's steel, is wrong. And we ought to have a consistent policy that says we want fair trade with countries and stand up against dumping.
Mark, I thank you for your call. Listener comments online. Why do we assume only Americans are capable of advanced manufacturing skills? After all, it's American companies like Apple teaching workers across the world these skills. And on top of that, American consumers don't seem to demand goods made here, so why make it here?
Well, certainly I wouldn't say that Americans are the only people capable of advanced manufacturing.
You've not said that. Yeah.
But what I do make the case for, to the extent there is an argument for American exceptionalism in manufacturing, it is that we, at least the small and medium-sized manufacturers, really listen, respect, and value their employees. And the case I make is companies that are doing that, that are valuing their employees, that are paying them a good wage, that are providing a good environment, and that are encouraging them to challenge authority, challenge the conventional wisdom in a way that I think our country allows at its best, that gives us an advantage when it comes to customizing products, when it comes to innovation over more authoritarian countries. So even though our companies may be training workers in other parts of the world in the technical skills of advanced manufacturing, that may not lead to the same sense of democratic culture in those companies that gives rise to innovation, customization, and making novel products.
We're talking with U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce, Rokana, about his new book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. And we go to more of your calls, and we go to Dan. Dan, you're on.
Hey, I'm wondering what you think of the burgeoning maker movement in this country, championed by Dale Dougherty of Make Magazine and Chris Anderson of Wired, who consequently came out with a book recently, Makers, the New Industrial Revolution.
I'm a big fan. I wrote a blog about the Makers Movement, and it's a movement around the country with people spontaneously coming together in small groups and forums to make things, to encourage the ability to be a manufacturer. And I think it's terrific for three reasons. First, it's creating a value on manufacturing and a sense that this still matters. Secondly, it's providing an outlet for jobs and employment for individuals who have an aptitude for manufacturing. And third, it is showing that in this world, you can make things and start a business, at least a partial business, without some of the barriers that existed in the past. So I'm hopeful for the Makers Movement.
And I thank you for the call, and let me read some opinions here that are coming into us. Alan writes, now that we've given away our manufacturing to Chinese, Indian, U.S., and European corporations in China and India, where there is no minimum wage, unions, health care, workers' comp, environmental standards, EPA controls, work standards, legal recourse, uncontrolled currency, about the only way now to create jobs here is to impose big tariffs on these imported goods. Let's get our own manufacturing back by making an even playing field. Another strong opinion from Tony, who says, the workers at Tesla are not unionized, unfortunately. I believe that's what I heard your guest say. It seems to me that $30 an hour, $60,000 per year, is more than workers would earn if they had a union. You want to respond to either of those?
Sure. The $30 an hour was not for Tesla. It was for Steel Dynamics. So they aren't union, but they are paying well. On the first comment, you know, statistically, we still are a world leader in manufacturing. If there's one point the book makes, it says, just look at the facts. We make about 20% of the world's goods. China makes about 20% of the world's goods. So it's just not true that we've lost all our manufacturing capacity. And we're not going to compete in all types of manufacturing. We have to figure out what type of manufacturing we can compete in and then do it well by paying a good wage, by having the right work environment, by fostering creativity, and that will give us a comparative advantage. I'm not for a trade war. I do think, though, we need to take tough actions against countries that aren't playing by the same rules to say, have a fair currency, stop dumping. And if you are dumping, then yes, we should have punitive sanctions on those products that are being dumped into our shores, because that's only a fair price.
Well, apropos your comments, another email comes from Andrew in San Jose, who writes, as someone who believes the government can play a constructive and guiding role with respect to the economy, I do sometimes wonder to what extent it can predict emerging industries. I think conservatives, despite the explanations your guest just gave, would point to Solyndra as a failure of this type of planning. Can you give a few examples of where predictive planning has led to real successes, and what are some nascent industries that you think could thrive with government intervention?
Well, I am of the view that government cannot go pick winners and losers or pick what next industry that we should support. That said, government can support basic science and technology. There are two types of innovation. There is a...
And R&D.
And there are two types of innovation. There's continuous innovation and there's disruptive innovation. Continuous innovation is sort of the private sector can do very well, tinkering on the margin, seeing how we can make a product better. Disruptive innovation requires a fundamental shift in the science and technology underneath a product's And for that, the government has a role. In DARPA, in ARPA-E, which is funding research in whole sorts of new energy technology, whether it's solar, wind, nuclear, whether it's the integral fast reactor, we can look at, and it's agnostic about which technology, we need to, or whether it's the National Institute of Health, which is funding new technologies for medicine. We need to look at funding basic research science and technology, or of course the laboratories here back home with the Livermore National Laboratory or Sandia, which are doing extraordinary work on supercomputing, on energy. Fund these institutions, figure out how to commercialize that technology, and then let the private sector figure out what the industries will be.
John is our next caller. John, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Thank you for this great program. I'm just finishing a 35-year career managing a manufacturing business, and we've got a basic question for you. Why would anybody choose to go to work in manufacturing? I'll give you an example. We had an incident at my business 6 months ago, and my lead guy was out in the parking lot talking with a local police officer. My lead guy can program any CNC machine tool made. He can run SolidWorks, all the programs. He's an accomplished machinist. He makes about $65,000 a year. That's what he costs. The police officer that was interacting with my employee, I talked to him later, and then I checked the website to see what he costs. He costs $175,000 a year, roughly three times what my employee costs. So I'm not at all surprised that when Cal Fire wants to hire some employees, they have to rent the Sacramento Fairgrounds because of the turnout. So why would somebody go to work in a manufacturing business with all the skills, training, et cetera, required to compete today when somebody can get a job, as a safety worker and make three times as much, retire age 50, with a retirement that's 90%+ of what they make working? Can you answer that?
Well, kind of.
Well, let me first focus on the parts of the comments that I agree with. I think you're absolutely right that you have to have extraordinary skill to be competitive in manufacturing today, and I appreciate your highlighting that because the fact that you have to operate CNC machines and know programming, it's tough, difficult work, and those individuals deserve as much respect in our society as lawyers, as doctors, as talk show hosts, as journalists. And so there, I agree. On your example, I just disagree with the anecdote. Most police officers I know don't make $175,000 a year. So I think it's just not accurate, certainly as a median salary. Most of them are much more close to the $60,000 to $70,000 range that you describe for your employee. And they do very hard work. They're putting their lives at risk every day. And so
I think the caller said that the officer costs the government that much.
Is that what the caller?
That is what you said, isn't it, John? Are you still there? No.
Well, I mean, the solution, in my judgment, first of all, manufacturing jobs pay about 20% more than service jobs statistically, and the challenge is not to bash the police or fire. The question is, if anything, you say people at elite law firms like my own and or Wall Street are making gazillions of dollars. That's a bigger question than the poor person who's out there in public safety. So I think the fact is that manufacturing is still a pathway to the middle class. It still pays about 20% more on average than service jobs. The challenge is that there's been income disparity even within manufacturing. People who have skills have opportunities for these higher paying jobs. Those without skills don't have the job to be making $50,000, $60,000 and in the middle class. And what we ought to be doing is supporting manufacturing and all middle class jobs that can lead to the middle class, whether they're in manufacturing, whether they're in certain types of services, whether they're fire or police, and figure out how we can have a stable middle class in this country.
But I've never heard the middle class mentioned so much as in this presidential campaign. You would think everybody's in the middle class except perhaps, I don't know, even the one percenters.
Well, it's an American tradition to be identified with the middle class.
You mentioned your law firm. We should probably mention it's Wilson Sonsini.
It's a great firm, by the way. I don't want to get in trouble.
No, many in Silicon Valley know it as one of the premier firms. Matthew tweets, give startups a one-year break from fees like incorporation and other licenses. Let them start before they are regulated. Thank you, Matthew. And as you can imagine, a lot of emails coming in about China. Just let me give you sampling here. Bill says, despite the efficient steel industry in the United States, the Chinese apparently still undercut U.S. manufacturers in supplying steel for the new Bay Bridge. How could U.S. companies have won that contract? Bradley says, China heavily petitioned to gain entry to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, considering how they have since used many WTO forbidden trade practices. Please comment on when will China face the other side of the WTO coin and be subjected to WTO regulations, to wit, solar panels dumped on the U.S. market. So we get to the China problem here right away.
And no one is tougher on China. In my book, I take China on currency manipulation, on intellectual property theft, on not allowing our companies to sell products there, on not allowing the internet internet access for their own citizens, which I think is suppressing human rights and democracy. And certainly we need a tougher approach, a diplomatic approach to having reform in China. That said, I don't think it's wise for us to blame all our problems on China. That would be too easy to say, well, if only China played by the rules, we'd have a healthy manufacturing base and a middle class.
Well, we're going to have to let it stop at that, but listeners can continue on our website to make your comments, kqed.org/forum or on our Facebook page. Ro Khanna, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, his book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk to Ang Lee, famed filmmaker, Academy Award winner. When we return, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.